For taking a ride on the Freedom Train. I am your host, Joseph Ward, and as always, ride with me is my good friends, Mr. Patrick Irvin, Mr. Jamie Bushon. Remember, PAX Inc. is sponsored by, the Freedom Train is sponsored by PAX Inc. That's PACTSINC. And PAX Inc. is a black advocacy organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the interest of hard work, honesty, and integrity. And for more information, make sure you visit www.pactsinc.org. And as always, remember, once you're on the website, make sure you click on the tab that says The Code so you can learn more about the codes of conduct that were created by PAX Inc. to help socialize black America into working as a cohesive unit once again. While you're online, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com to learn more about our amazing guests, to hear the playbacks of these shows, and to learn more about myself, Patrick, and Jamie. You can follow us on Instagram at Freedom Train Network. Follow us on Twitter at Freedom Train Net. Like our Freedom Train Facebook page. Subscribe to the Freedom Train on YouTube. So go to youtube.com/Freedom Train Network. And last but not least, make sure that you subscribe to the Freedom Train on iTunes or Google Play Music. And that way you can get the notifications coming right to your phone. And you can keep up with us and stay in the loop on what we got going on. Patrick, Jamie,
What's good? What's good, everybody?
Cool.
We need a checklist or something. That's a lot of stuff they got to do.
Yeah, it was.
Hey, man. You could choose either or. You ain't got to. We're just giving them options. You know how we do.
I got you. Jordan gave them every. Yeah, you can email us. You can call my house. You can show up at my house.
You can send a smoke signal, Pony Express, send it by a pigeon, whatever you need to do. We got you.
Joe is that overly friendly person at work.
Hey, Charles, you want to come to the barbecue? No, Joseph. I told you this.
Hey, man, well, you're going to miss out on all this good barbecue over here. So once again, you know, it's August, and we're still in our mental health awareness month. And so far, it's been going great. Make sure you all go to our Freedom Train YouTube channel as well as our Freedom Train Facebook page to check out the playbacks of our interviews as well as our PSAs that we have covering mental health. And speaking of our PSAs, before we get deep into what we have going on today with our interview, and before we introduce our guests, I want to go ahead and play another one of our PSAs, and then we're going to go ahead and get deep into what we have for you all today. So check it out.
Take the time to take care of our bodies, our looks, and even our money. We invest in our dreams, and we invest in other people. But we must invest more time and resources on taking care of our mental health. Truth is, we push mental health issues under the rug. We must change the way we perceive mental health and those that suffer from it. It is our responsibility to heal our community.
And that was Miss Alicia Hall helping us out with that PSA. So thank you, Alicia, for that. And Pat, Jamie, y'all ready to learn a little more about our guest or a lot more about our guest?
Absolutely, man. Let's do it.
Hey, man, you better say that again like you excited.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
There you go.
Did that sound better?
That sound, for you. It was good for you.
You're just starting already.
But on the show, I was looking through this young lady's website, and like I told her, I'm very impressed about what she has done in the past, what she was able to overcome, and what she's still doing. So we have Miss Evandra Catherine, who I'm going to call her Dr. Catherine because she's a full-time PhD student at Virginia Commonwealth, and her program is Special Education and Disability Policy. She's also a United States Air Force veteran. She's a social activist. She's a public speaker, and she's also 2015's Richmond, Virginia Top 40 Under 40. So she has been doing some great things in her life. She was able to overcome obstacles and still be strong enough to not just focus on herself, but give time to her people in her community. And, you know, we don't really find people who can not be selfish, but people who are selfless, especially for the community that we have and the things that we're pushing forward. So without further ado, I want to introduce to you all Dr. Evandra Catherine. How are you doing today, Evandra?
Hello, gentlemen. How are you all today?
We're good, we're good. Thank you. See, they had to come out for you. So thank you for being on the Freedom Train.
I'm ready to ride this train.
Uh-oh. Yes, ma'am. Well, you heard of Patrick. Well, it's on you. You got the first question. Let's do it.
All right. Well, so you've done a lot. You've done a lot, as Joe has illustrated with what he read out, and it is very impressive. And in the middle of doing all of that, we find you here on the show to talk about mental health issues. Can you give our listeners some of the things that you've maybe gone through or and some of the things that makes mental health awareness so important to you, for you?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, mental health is something that begins very, very early in life. And depending on what that experience is after the doctor spanks you on your bottom, it's pretty much how your mental health is going to be. And I was born into this world into some mess. So I spent pretty much 9 years of my 18 childhood years homeless. And I've experienced a lot of trauma due to that, physical trauma. I've been sexually abused multiple times by multiple people, all the way up to the age of 15 years old, probably even 18 if I consider all situations. And I was raised with no family at all whatsoever. So I've been alone most of my life, and literally alone most of my life. I've come across many people as friends and things like that, whose parents, you know, would take me in, et cetera. But really, I really was a loner. I was raised alone. And at 18, I went to the Air Force, as was mentioned, to escape, really, homelessness and abuse and trauma. And so going from a life of no structure to complete structure was when my mental health became a problem. So the Air Force is where I was diagnosed with a mental health illness, and I didn't really know that I had one at all. I didn't know what mental health really was. I didn't know anything about depression and anxiety and all those things. I missed all that along the way trying to survive. And so that's kind of how my journey began with my mental health, and that would have been around 2003 when I first started. So I'm about 13, 14 years out since I very first started therapy and being aware of my mental health challenges.
Okay.
Stop right there. So you said you first learned about your mental health condition when you were in the Air Force. Dealing with that, you know, being in the, you know, Air Force military environment, how did you cope with it at first, and how long did it take you to go seek out that medical attention that you needed?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was referred from higher up that, you know, maybe therapy would be good for you kind of thing. I didn't really know I had a problem, and I hadn't been exposed to mental health being a stigma. And I'll be 35 coming up in January. So in the 90s is when I was in high school, and, you know, mental health just wasn't something that was real big around the spaces that I were. Like I said, I was very much alone a lot of the time. So I didn't know what mental health was. So I got referred in. I didn't have to actually seek it out. But when I first started, it was very it was known that, okay, this is what she needs. And so I ended up coming in to therapy at once a week. You know, so I'm going four times a month kind of thing. And I had to relive all the trauma that I had suppressed my entire life just to survive. And as Black people, we typically are in survival mode, and that means that a lot of things that should be taken care of or acknowledged are not, because we have to survive, so we can't, you know, waddle in our woes. And so that's kind of how my introduction into getting help started. And reliving my trauma ultimately pushed me into inpatient. So I ended up in inpatient probably about, I would say, maybe 9 to 10 months after first starting therapy. And I was inpatient for about a month, and it was in up in D.C., and it was all military facilities, so it wasn't what people would see on television or think an institution is like. You know, it was much different for me because I was in the military.
Okay. Okay. So leading up to you going into the Air Force, when you didn't necessarily, or when you weren't necessarily fully knowledgeable about your mental health condition, can you describe for us a typical day when your, I guess when things were not at its best, and what were your biggest challenges leading up to you really figuring out or learning about your mental health?
You know, what's interesting is that a typical day, I was looking at that question, and the day that I went into inpatient, this was what a typical day was, and I wasn't aware it was my typical day. But I had become so disillusioned and detached from reality, from the world that I was in, but I was functioning in it, to the point where I was working at the Pentagon. I lived in, I think, Alexandria at the time, which is about maybe 20 minutes apart. So I got off work at 4:30, got home maybe about 5. I obviously, you know, when you're depressed, you sleep a lot. So I went to sleep. I woke up a couple hours later. I think it was about 7:30, but it was in the springtime, so it was still super bright outside, but it looked like early morning to me. I called my NCO, and I said, oh, my God, I'm in a panic. I'm late to work. I'm so sorry. You know, I'm getting dressed right now. I'm about to get myself to work. I'll see you in a little bit, right? Because I had to be to work at 7:30 in the morning. My supervisor says to me, he says, Airman, it is 7:30 p.m. Mind you, I just left work 3 hours ago. I was that disillusioned and that detached that those 3 hours of sleep felt like a whole entire 24 hours to me, and I was late to work. And I bring that up because that was my typical day. I would go to work. I would go home, and I would become even more further attached, and I didn't have any awareness of self at all. I just didn't know who I was, why I existed, why I was living. And so after that 8 to 5, I went into total despair as to why do I live and who am I? And that who am I question had so much to do with the fact that I didn't know who I was as a Black person. I didn't know, and when I say I didn't know who I was as a Black person, in order to live, you have to have purpose, regardless of what you're going through in life. And if you don't know who you are as an individual, it's very hard to have purpose. You know what I mean? And I'm coming straight out of homelessness, straight into red tape. I'm in the Pentagon, all white people, all generals and high-ranking officers, very few Black people I'm interacting with. It was just like a shock to me, and I think dealing with where I came from and dealing with the environment of the military and not knowing who I was and why I existed, it just really made it a typical day was just trying to understand those things, but not realizing I was trying to understand those things. And interacting with people who have mental health challenges, that's typically like it's a similar story. A lot of people just don't know that they're trying to figure out something or struggle through something, and it just causes mental health issues to become worse, and the depression becomes worse, and different other symptoms and things like that just become worse. So a typical day is just either you want to sleep it away, or you want to ask so many questions as to why me, or you try to find a way to exit. And I can honestly say on this radio station that I've tried to find ways to exit this earth, and do that myself. And I had a very rational reason why it would be okay to the Most High. You know, it gets to that level, you know. That was a typical day.
That's deep. No, that's a lot. And first of all, thank you for sharing all that, because one thing you're doing here by kind of telling your story, there's a lot of people that are going to listen to this that can relate. So hearing you tell your story, and not only tell it, but you survived it. You know, you went and got the help, you did all that, and you're here to talk about it. You know, that's going to be very powerful for a lot of people that may be dealing with mental health issues and things like that. So thank you for sharing all this. This is dope.
Oh,
if y'all don't mind, I want to ask this, because as you were talking, Jamie, you made me think of something. after the first interview we did for mental health awareness, we had somebody comment, and the comment was basically saying that, what's the purpose of seeking help if those around you will not take you serious or make fun of you? Being somebody who has been able to go through all the challenges that you've been through, what kind of advice would you give to someone who wants to seek help but may not seek help because of the people around them not making them feel comfortable about seeking help?
First, it's a matter of, you know, what's important to you as an individual, and that's very hard to determine when you have mental health challenges. But seeking help is something that a person can do without not other people being aware, right? And so it becomes a situation where if you want the support of those around you, you have to know if those around you are going to support you before you tell them. Otherwise, seeking help sometimes you do have to do in private. You know, it's something that you and that person sitting in front of you only have to experience. However, having people around you to support you is great, but no one really truly knows how to support a person that has mental health challenges. You know, it's just not like you can take a certain regimen every day and it works. Every day is not going to be the same. You never know what someone's button might be that day, what a trigger might be. So it's just not a really good, it's not a good situation to be in as a supportive person because you just don't know how, and it becomes intimidating to you. And then ultimately you make it harder on the person that's going through it. And we all do it because it's just a hard place. But my recommendation is to seek therapy as soon as you realize you may need it. And I'm 13 years out, and I can speak to who I would choose to sit in front of today. But 13 years ago, it didn't matter. I needed to sit in front of somebody. I needed to start the process. I needed to at least know what it was that I was dealing with and where I was going from there. You know, so I didn't care if the person was white. I didn't care if they was black, male, female, old, young. As long as I knew they were credentialed to sit there and help me along the way, that's all that matters. So individuals need to seek help until they feel comfortable with those in their circle that they can share that with. Otherwise, it only hurts you not to seek it because you don't feel like you have support.
All right. Thank you for that.
And to that, I have a question about your support. Did you have a support group when you were going through the various things you were going through?
So not at all. So when I explained to you I grew up alone, that's a real true statement. I did not get to a point where I could say I had a support system or someone I would even want to call like a friend or someone close until I was about 23 years old, you know, and that's from birth to 23 that I had to live a life with no one to support me. Everything I've done has totally been on my own. There's been people along the way, of course, that, you know, has touched my life. But when it comes to it, no, everything was done alone. I had to learn coping skills. I had to learn how to form healthy relationships. I never knew how to do that. I had to learn how to not be around certain people. The level of trauma I experienced and what I saw on the street was my norm. So the type of people that I would end up around would be those individuals. And as you get older in life and get more successful, you know, you have to decide what people you're going to be around. But my norm was the street. The people that I was comfortable around was those people, and those were negative relationships. And those were the only type of relationships I knew how to form. I didn't know how to form positive relationships. I didn't know how to love me. I didn't know how to love someone else. And I didn't know if what someone was actually showing me was love or not. So, you know, I had to figure out how to create that support system.
Now, that's like a lot of people, you know, deal with that. They don't have that support system, and it's unfortunate you had to go, you know, start from ground level from that. But again, you know, people hearing this interview, they can, you know, figure out better ways and get that support system and hopefully lose some of the issues and complications that come along with having a mental health issue. But one question, I'm going off script here. I know Joe gonna get mad at me and reel me in a second.
Whatever.
So, in your opinion, coming off the street, you know, dealing with the things, the adversity you had to do early in life, do you feel the Air Force or the military in general may have complicated your mental health, or was it a medium to actually help you get the care and recognize the issues you had from a mental health aspect?
You know, the military was like a big present and a bow for me, because I went there for a particular reason, and that was to escape where I was leaving from. And so when I got there, it was more so people looking at me and just trying to figure out what is the best way to help me, because I was succeeding so well in the military in my actual day-to-day job. Like, I made E5 before I had even turned 21 years old, so 20, and I went in at 18. And the average person in the military to make E5 is like 8 to 11 years, and here I made it in 2. So it was like, okay, we have this super successful, ambitious, driven young 18-year-old out of high school, but then yet she also has this emptiness in her eyes and this emptiness in her aura. And people around me saw that. I didn't know this. This is in hindsight. So the military was a place where there were people that actually genuinely cared about me. I didn't know what that felt like, you know. So it was very hard to acknowledge it and receive it. But when I look back today along the way, it was just people there pushing me to get help the entire time. That was really everyone's focus was, you need to get therapy. And my military career, honestly, outside of work and being there on September 11, 2001, it really was me getting the help that I should have gotten all throughout life. And that's where I received it at, was in the military. I don't think that the military would be good for, you know, someone in my situation. I don't like to call myself an anomaly, but I just handle things differently. But the pressures of the military and coming from the lifestyle that I had, it would be much more difficult for a person. They would probably get themselves in trouble first over something that really wasn't that serious in the outside world, but was that serious in the military, just because the pressure of the structure and the authority of it was just a lot. But absolutely. I had been on the street. And so, you know, that was easy for me to handle. You know what I mean? But I don't know. It was great for me seeking out self. And then once I started to seek out myself, I realized that I was in a city that people call Chocolate City. And I just was finally, for the first time, interacting with blackness at that same time, that I'm also becoming more self-aware and learning about my mental health. And so actually it started to push me down Martin Luther King Boulevard to where there were black people that had struggles, that were struggling just like me, but I was no longer on the streets with them, but I still had the same struggle. And then that's when I started to realize, like, who am I? And my mental health challenge always brought me back to that question, who am I and what is my purpose? And that's really important for your mental health, because if you have no purpose, you just can't have strong mental health. It's just, you don't wake up every morning with some sense of urgency to do something. And you have to have some agency in yourself and a sense of urgency to want to do something, no matter what that something is. If you don't have that, it's just hard to not have a mental health issue.
Okay.
No, definitely. Because you've hit on several very, very, very excellent points. The point you made earlier about not being able to or not knowing what a healthy relationship is, you know, that is a wonderful point, because we find that several people in the community and several segments of the community, even that have family structures and things of that nature, still don't know what a positive relationship is. They still don't know what a healthy relationship is. And for you to speak to that as a component of mental health is very, very key, because I think a lot of people don't realize that a lot of their negative relationships are exacerbating whatever mental health issues they might have or might be developing. And then when you speak to having a sense of agency or having a sense of purpose, because I was in the military as well, Air Force as well, and while I would not, definitely my experience wasn't as beneficial as yours seems to have been, it definitely did cement my purpose. And like you said, there is a tremendous amount of confidence that gives you to know, this is my purpose. This is what I feel like I'm supposed to be doing. And it does make things easier to deal with. It makes it easier to move forward with a couple of things. So I just wanted to highlight those points, because those were, in my opinion, two exceptionally powerful points that you just made.
Well, I appreciate it. And I would be the first to admit that I just learned how to form positive relationships about 2 years ago. So we're talking about 32 years old. It took me 32 years of life to know what a healthy, positive relationship is. So if anyone is listening, it's never too late to figure it out. Like, even if you're beyond my age and you still don't know what it is, it's okay. Because when it happens, it feels good to know. But it's not your fault that you don't know how to form them. Because if you've never seen them or interacted with them, it's not your fault that you don't know how to recognize them or how to create
them. That's so true.
Right.
No, but that's true. And even outside of the realm of mental health, people truly do not know how to form healthy relationships. I was in my late 20s when I learned what a healthy relationship was. And, you know, late 20s, early 30s when I really learn how to be a part of a healthy relationship, first loving myself and loving others. So that is so true what you're saying, and that's a critical component that we need as black people to learn how to have those healthy relationships with ourselves and others.
Let's be real about it. How many opportunities does a young black kid have to really see or experience a healthy relationship?
Yeah.
That's a fact. Yeah, I mean, it's a fact, but, you know, it depends on the environment, because we even have some kids who grew up in two-parent households who still never see or experience healthy relationships. So.
But we're not talking about the situations that are at hand. I mean, you know, like we talked about before, we're not talking about all those things where you would perceive that person has been in or experienced a healthy relationship, because, you know, I think the number is 70 or 80% of children grow up in dysfunctional families. You know, when a lot of those families are two-parent households, you know, there are people that are married with kids that don't have a healthy relationship with their spouse, don't have a healthy relationship with their children. So, you know, and when she speaks to the necessity of knowing how to, she didn't use necessity, I'm using that on my own. But when she, because I don't want to put words in her mouth. But when she speaks to the necessity of healthy relationships and how that relates to your mental health, if all of your relationships are broken, like, that's something you really need to look at, what's going on. Either you keep bumping into broken people, you're broken, or both. And if those three things are happening, then there is something going on with your mental health. And that's something that we all need to be looking at constantly. Especially the adults. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just
But you're right. Yeah. You're right. But well, I have this question. Now your way of receiving mental health was a little different than others, because some people may have to go out and seek it. You were referred, but being that you've gone through the process, in your opinion, what factors are important for people when they're choosing someone to help them? And also, how were you able to learn who you are and sort of find yourself?
Okay, definitely. So I have had to seek mental health help multiple times. I got out of the military back in 2005. We're in 2017 right now. And so my mental health challenges did not end when I left. So for 12 years, I've had to seek it on my own. So in the, like I said, initially, at first, you just got to find somebody. It doesn't really matter. But then as you go through the process, you start to look for what you're looking for. My last therapist, or my current one, is a black woman, you know, and I actually sought out a black woman. But only because I became more conscious of myself and more aware of who I am, and I just knew the things that I had faced in life, I felt would be much harder for a non-black person to be able to relate to those things. However, it depends on resources and what you have access to, because if there are things that you say you want and it's not available to you, it, you know, still sets you back behind. So I chose that because of my own personal growth, where I was at that time, discovering who I was and understanding that being black in America is something that maybe perhaps only I wanted to talk to another black person about. I didn't want to sit in front of someone who may have felt guilty within themselves about why I was sitting there and what I had been through, or not even able to understand what I was saying. But most importantly, I would say you want to seek out someone who you want to schedule an initial introduction with them if you can to see if they're going to be a good fit. Talk to them, find out their background, research them, what is their level of education, where did they go to school, those type of things. Location, their accessibility, how close are they to you? Are they on the bus line? Because, like I said, if you don't have a support system and you don't have a vehicle, you can't say, hey, can you take me to my therapy appointment? It just doesn't work. So for you want to make sure that you can get to your therapist when you need to and they're available when you need to. If you work, it's a really great and you get full-time benefits because most companies, private have and public, have that EAP hotline, that employee hotline. So typically you call them, it's confidential, you tell them you have problems, and they'll give you a list of people that the insurance covers. That's how I sought out my mental health probably the first 5 years after I got out of the military because I was employed, and I didn't know any other way to do it being outside of the military. For those that don't work, there are community service boards for each county or city that you live in. Phone number you can call. You can ask them for a list of providers, whether they're on a sliding scale, they take insurance, they don't take insurance. But I think most importantly, it's knowing what your options are and what your access is, knowing whether or not you have insurance or you don't have insurance and which way you should go. But to seek out a person, it's really, really one of those things that it depends on where you are with your mental health and how badly you need to sit in front of somebody before you want to start looking to see, okay, are you this, are you that, are you this, are you that? You know, but like I said, and as I grew and as I learned more about myself and became better, then I actually sought out a particular person, a black woman. Okay. But in the 13 years I've been going through this, I only sought out characteristics in a therapist one time, and that was after 13 years of growth. I don't think it mattered to me much at all before, other than knowing that I needed help and I needed to do something for me. And I couldn't care what the person in front of me, you know, what they look like or any of those things. I just needed to get the help. The answer, the second part of your question, and that was about me finding myself. Is that correct?
Correct.
I think that was the second part of your question. Okay, thanks. So
yes.
The truth of the matter is I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer, and I knew that it didn't matter what your undergraduate degree was in order to be an attorney. And so I was going to be paying for my education myself. And so I felt like if I was going to pay for my education, I might as well pay to learn who I am. So I ended up going to Virginia Commonwealth University, where I am now, for my undergraduate. But I majored in African American studies. And that is where my sense of self-worth began, when I learned that my history actually did not begin at 1607 at Jamestown, or that it did not begin at 1865 at the end of the Civil War. When I learned that I came from a continent of greatness, when I learned that I was a minority only in the United States, but I was a majority in the rest of the world, and when I realized that everything that the Europeans claim is there was stolen from African people, it was not very much longer after that I realized, hold on, Evandra, wait a minute. What are you talking about? You don't want to live, or you have low self-esteem, or all those things, those negative qualities that I harbored every single day. When I could hold my chest out and I could look at somebody and just know that everything that's coming out your mouth was stolen from me and my people, it was over for me after that. And it began at that point that my mental health also got better, because that is when I realized I had a duty to let the rest of the world know what I had just found out. And I'm still in the process of doing that in 2017. It might take me all the way to my dying bed, but when everybody that's black or brown know that we are responsible for everyday living, these roads people drive on, they were initially laid by enslaved Africans. You know what I mean? Everything that people experience today is a result of enslaved Africans and their labor. And it was a point in this country, I'm so off task, but it was a point in this country where it was like, you look at a white woman, you lay in roll tomorrow. You know what I mean? And it's like,
right. Until we
can understand the everyday quality of life that people are experiencing is a result of the foundations that enslaved Africans and other brown and native people are responsible for, how can I walk around in America with my head hanging low and not knowing who I am when I am who America is? You know, and that's just like that's how I live, that's how I think now, and that actually helps my mental health, because whenever I have a low day or I don't feel like rolling up and getting out of the bed, I think about how many people still don't know that America, they are responsible for who America is. And so that's how it all began. And from 2006, the spring semester of African American Studies, all the way to today, I have been on a mission to let everybody know what I found out during those 2 years at VCU learning about black people. And it's just like it's my duty to do so, because it changes everything. When a person can look at you like you're nothing and you look at them like, please, you know, like, you exist because I exist. Let's talk about it. You know, I can break it down
right
for you. It gives you a level of confidence that regardless of anything, you know who you are.
That yeah is
freaking speak that
dope
truth. Speak that truth.
The fact that you just paralleled knowing thyself with improving your mental health, I think that's important because, you know, in American society, we're taught to see ourselves through the eyes of Europeans and the dominant society, X, Y, and Z. But that awakening process, it seems like you really saw more value in yourself, and in return, that enlightened you. It kind of brought you out of those mental health. You know, you still might, but now you have that confidence. Now you have that ability to, like you said, you know, hey, I'm here for a purpose. Like, you know, I started this. I'm a black woman. I birthed the earth. Like, what are we really talking about here? Why am I really down on myself? So that parallel, that alone is freaking awesome. But it's why I'm going off script, too, so don't worry about it. We go off script a lot on this show. So, I'm probably never on topic, so feel free. But one thing I really want to start asking, I guess, what's one thing you said the spring semester 2006? What's that one thing that initially started you to really become aware of who you are and what you are? Because for me, it was a book, Anthony T. Browder, his book. It really started waking me up and making me start being more curious about who I am as a black man. What was that one thing for you that really kind of just, you know, started that little flame that turned into a fire for you to understand, you know, the significance of who you are and what you represent in this world?
You know, mine was a national event, you know, Genesis, if y'all remember the Genesis.
Yes.
So when I started the spring semester of 2006 at VCU, I think that is when Michael Bell started to go on trial. I think that's when it all started to happen, right around that time. And everybody was getting in buses and driving to Louisiana, and I was told by all these organizations on campus I needed to wear all black and black out. And I am like, what is going on? What? Why? What happened? Like, a noose in a tree? Like, what's that? What's going on? You know what I mean? I was totally confused. Like, who? I'm not getting on no bus and going to Louisiana, and I'm definitely not wearing all black. So that national event, I had to start questioning why was so many black people so upset and doing all these things. And mind you, I had not had any real Afrocentric education. I'm educated on a Western perspective. So I didn't really get the civil rights movement. I didn't really get our struggles in the 70s, the 60s, and to know this is what we do, this is what we're facing, this is what the southern part of the United States was, you know what I mean? And so I had to take it like, wow, this is what we've been doing since the 60s, and it's 2000 and something? Can you, like, it brought me to that point. Like, I was wowed every single moment during that one little period of time where so many people were hurt and outraged about what was happening to Michael Bell and the rest of the Gen of Six. And that is when I started to figure out, like, oh, I have a problem because I don't even know these things as a black person. Had never been introduced to them. Had I not became an African-American studies major, I don't think I would have ever known about the struggles of Jim Crow South and Reconstruction and post-Civil War. I don't think I would have ever learned it the way that I learned it then. I would have saw, you know, this monument stuff that happened or the South Carolina up the pole situation, you know, I would have started finding out, oh, okay, these things exist for a normal person that hasn't gotten an Afrocentric education. So I had to learn that this is a part of my history and what happened in Louisiana, I should be upset about. I should be mad about that. And that is when I started to figure out that I didn't really truly know what was going on, and I needed to know real quick what was going on and who I am and why people that looked at me are so upset about a noose in a tree. Because to truth be told, I didn't know what a noose was, I think, before Genesis. And that's unfortunate because I was at least 22 at that time. So it was a matter of just a national event. Like, in my lifetime at that point in time, nothing had happened that was major enough to become something I was aware of or I was old enough to be aware of.
No, that's yeah, that's good right there.
And just to be off topic a little bit, I lived all over the place because of my life, my childhood. But when I was in Texas, I lived in Texas for a while, And I remember when I was in the seventh grade that I used to wake up in the morning and put this CoverGirl white makeup on my face and wash my hair so that it would be wet when I went outside so that I could be like all the white kids at school. Like, it was part of my me trying to become them at the same time not knowing why it was that I was trying to become them. This is a 13-year-old girl, you know. I was in school. I hated when there would be a substitute teacher and my real black name got said. I went by the name Shauna all the way through school, you know. And those type of things play into our mental health. And as we grow and get older, like I said, at that age and time, I didn't know that I was trying to become white or what that even meant, you know. I didn't know. I knew why I was ashamed of my name. I was ashamed of my name because it wasn't white, you know. But all of that plays a role into who I was. And had I not found out or had my awakening, I might still be trying to become white. I might still be Shauna. Like, those things might still be my reality. And I probably would have never been awakened. You know, I would have never ended up in a all-black city to where I could become awakened even more every day. I would have probably tried to go somewhere as white as can be with my black self in his black-ass name. Sorry for the language.
No, you can, on this show, you're free to talk.
Yeah,
we're actually being good because I haven't dropped one F-bomb yet, and I'm so proud of myself right now.
Okay, well, that's good. But yeah, it's I think that being free of bondage and being free of mental slavery will take us so far as a people, and it will also significantly decrease the amount of mental health challenges that we experience. And I know that I am a female voice speaking right now, but what is not recognized often is black males, and they are not getting treatment. They are not seeking help. They are not talking to anybody about it. And because of their masculinity, they're not even expressing it. You know what I mean? And we have black men out here that are just not getting mental health treatment whatsoever. And that is something that is significantly important and that we need a national campaign to address. Because when we talk about the stigma in the black community, I don't think a black woman would mind going and seeking help or being told. But a black man will look at you in your face like you just said, like his mother died or something, when you say, you need to get some help. It's just not happening. I'm a man. What you mean? I can handle anything that's put on me. And that's not true. And some of these senseless killings and things that we do in our neighborhoods and communities, it's just the results of untreated mental health, unresolved issues that one can't handle. And that's important to me, you know, being a black woman and knowing that my black men are out here needing someone to even hold them and give them a hug and nurture them. And they're not going to get help, but it's like they can't go home either and get it, you know.
Right.
And not to bring up gay issues, but when you have to consistently get help from someone that has the same biological organs and things as you are, you know, feelings become involved, and it's very much more psychological at that point. But we're having a problem right now in our black community. Our black men are starting to find other ways to express that trauma that they hold in and where they're getting those needs met. And as a black woman, I feel like I have a duty and the rest of us have a duty to start embracing our black men again and giving them a hug, at least until we can get them to get some help. But a hug will go a long way, metaphorically, though, but and also literally.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
That what you just spoke on, we can have a whole show on that right now. Because I mentor a few young men, and, you know, it's, even myself, you know, coming from a single-parent household, you know, I was never taught how to deal with a lot of emotions. And what I find out is, young man, you deal with a lot of emotions, and you're kind of just told, to, all right, you just man up, you know, man up, this, that, and other. You know, we thought it's weak to cry or have, you know, these feelings of depression, and you're showing weakness, this, that, and other. So when you talk about a lot of these killings with these young people out here, a lot of them just don't know how to deal with those emotions, being angry, realizing you don't have to, you know, be this alpha male, this, that, and the other. They just don't know how to process that emotion. And it results to violence and stuff like that. So that right there, that's like a whole damn 8-hour show we could do. A telethon, if you will.
Right.
No, but it is, because that's something that, like, and I said it on one of the other shows, like, I've gone through mental health issues. I've had to go see someone about depression. And me and Joe talk all the time about, this current this masculinity box there is right now, where men are almost seen as subhumans, like we aren't allowed to experience the full range of emotions without being called a punk or something for it.
Right, facts.
And so
you're soft if you express yourself.
Yeah, and it's one of them things that, you know, me and Joe talk about often off air, and maybe it is, maybe we do need to have a show about that, about masculinity, and about, because I completely agree that a lot of the things that we're bumping into in the community are the result of emotions that are out of control, mental health issues that haven't been dealt with, and other community-based stigmatisms that just aren't going to be fixed because of the current paradigm. And that, like, man, you know, emotional masculinity is almost as toxic as crackhead. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's crazy how that works. But it is a very, 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 very powerful, another yes. very powerful point.
Yes. So, with that being said, Evander, I have a question. Because the stigma in the black community is strong surrounding mental health. So, what advice would you give someone, or what advice would you give to the black community on the best ways to break down that stigma and overcome that stigma, so we can be more open and be more willing to talk about mental health and actually seek more help, especially with our men?
You know, that's a very, very great question, and it's because a lot of us seeking any type of help has to do with us not seeking any type of help, has a lot to do with how we were used as experimental subjects for a long time in history. And when I think about the question, I can only think about the reasons why it is we don't just seek medical help in general, regardless if it's for your mental health or not, but even other things that we don't seek help for. In the black community, at this point, and with that not being a monolithic group of people, but a very multicultural group of individuals, we just need to know who we are at the beginning of the day when we wake up, and know that if we need to get help, we just go do it. And we can't worry about what the next man says, because regardless of what the next man's saying, we still have to live that life in that body, in that mind. And if we want to continue to live within our own minds without seeking help, that's not good for the greater good at all. And we need to begin to uplifting each other. And we have to start doing that by knowing where we're actually uplifting to. And we can't do that without knowing who we are. And it just really comes back to that question of what do we need to do in the black community? We need to know who we are. Because truth be told, if we walked around with the air that we should and the arrogance that we should and the confidence that we should, then really most of the struggles in the world wouldn't exist. But we need to understand, as I mentioned, like, we're responsible for this. Like, all right. of this is the black people created all of this. I don't know if you guys know how it goes. They said the only thing that white people ever created was the patent office.
Oh, yeah.
All of this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? All they did is stole our ideas. And if we had that
it's
sense stealing. Of arrogance, if we, exactly, if we had it, if that confidence, if we had it, man, it changes so many things. I work in an all-white, male-dominated space. I'm in politics, and I'm also in education, which is 80% white women. If I don't walk into a room, every second I walk into a room, I'm going to let you know I'm black, I'm a woman, and I'm proud to be in your presence, and you will respect my essence of being here. And I wear it on me. I don't act that way, or I don't speak that way, but I wear it on me. My head is held high. I'm making direct eye contact, and I will have on some red, black, and green, an unk or something somewhere. And it's like, you will respect me when I walk in this room. You will stand up as I stand up. You will sit down as I sit down. And if you want to talk about it, we can. But I believe the history and knowledge that I would speak to you will ask you to sit down. And it's just knowing who you are. And you can't tell me nothing about poverty if I know who I am. You can't put me in a concentrated area if I know who I am. Because what I'm going to do is leave and try to get everybody else there to leave with me. Because I know who I am. I'm not degrading myself to these living conditions, these educational conditions, these work conditions, any of this. Not in America, not when I created it, I'm not. And that's just that sense of arrogance we need to have. And I think that would move us beyond not talking about it.
I completely agree with you.
I don't know. I don't. I just don't understand. I know why we don't, but I wish that we did just know that we are the reason for everybody waking up in the morning.
And so,
right.
I got a question. Right. This is a little bit off topic for you. And because I'm listening to everything you're saying, and my thing is, when it came to mental health, and we talked about this last week on the show, what a lot of people try to do is they turn to religion. Let's be honest. They go to the pastor, they get in a good book, read a scripture or two, and next thing you know, they're all ready to fight the devil and all the mental health issues out of there. What's your take on that? You know, using religion to cope with mental health. While I know it can be productive, but for somebody who's actually dealing with mental health issues, do you feel that religion is sufficient enough to get somebody, you know, to the point where they need to be having a healthy lifestyle and whatnot? Your take.
You know, we all have to believe in something, and we all want to believe in something. So religion, you know, it's needed to a degree. I would guess spirituality. I'm not a very religious person. I don't, you know, subscribe to any book or any knowledge that people would like me to subscribe to. I'm very, very spiritual. But I think that, you know, if I speak from being raised Pentecostal, I know that I've gone to a pastor and I've told him what my woes were and I've asked him what he suggests or recommend, and it's pray and Jesus will work it out. And I think most people who go to their pastors are told to pray and Jesus will work it out. Well,
right.
You know, anytime I've ever gone to a church and listened to a sermon, it's all about what I can't do. And it's never about what I can do. And everyone has had different experiences with religion, but that's been my general overall experience. Every scripture, you can't do this. I mean, there's the Beatitudes, there's the whatever they got in there, the thou shalt not, and all this type of thing. When you're going through something, the last thing you need to hear are all the things that you shouldn't be doing, because that's probably all the things that you are doing. So then it just makes you feel even worse about yourself, because now the Most High is preaching directly to you because everything the preacher is saying you're doing. I don't think that that's just a place that one should go to seek mental health. One should go seek mental health by a licensed person, whether it's a licensed clinical social worker, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist, whatever level that you need. But your pastor, unless they are that and they're a regular 8-to-5, is not the one to go to, because Jesus can't work it out. You know, he can't do that. It's not what he's going to do. And he's not really being taught to us as someone that really likes black people much at all in the first place. So I don't know if I want a white man really telling me how to get my life together at all. And so,
right.
No, I don't think that's a good source. I think it's a place that you might go to maybe get some resources if you don't have any other connections to the community, but that is not the one to help you get over your woes. Praying about it is not the answer no more. It was never an answer. Praying about it can help you along the way, but it's not going to remove what you're dealing with and facing day to day, especially when the narrative is everything that you shouldn't do to be good. Well, damn, what do I do to be good? Because right now you're telling me what I shouldn't do to be good. But we don't get the knowledge that we actually have a duty to give back to our fellow man. And it's not to wake up every morning, go to work, pay the bills, go to church on Sunday and Wednesday, praise the Lord, and give him 10% of my income. That's definitely not where I'm going with that.
Right. But you know, you hit on something, though, that leads into that. It's that indoctrination that we've been given with our time in this land, thinking that, for one, you are here to just live and not reap any abundance from your work, not enjoy your time here. That's stressful. And then dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, dealing with that, and just the constant influx of stress that we get from the created conditions of white supremacy, as well as when we're buying into these Western ideas and traditions and things. So to me, that goes a lot into weighing on our mental health. And then we all, from what I see when I'm out in my communities, we're using drugs, alcohol, and unprotected sex and all these different things as coping mechanisms to help deal with what they don't even realize are mental health issues. So, you know, what is your take on that as far as the coping mechanisms, and what tips would you give people to find healthy means to be able to cope with what they're dealing with on a regular basis?
You know, I still in my struggles and working on coping skills, you know, on a day-to-day basis, because it's easy to want to go smoke a blunt, take a shot, you know, go have sex with somebody. Just it's easy to do all those negative, harmful things to the body as a way to cope. But what I would say I have managed to do to cope is to really just self-talk, talk to myself, you know, have people that I know we talk about people that don't have people there, but if you do have somebody, and I'll just give a real true female example, going through something and having a problem, and I want to go out to the club that night, put the freaking girl dress on, find me somebody, and just, you know, work it out, you know. But I'll pick up one of my male friends, and I'll be like, listen, this is what I'm trying to go do. And they'd be like, but you know in the morning when you're going to wake up, that's not going to be a good feeling for you. You know what I mean? That's actually me using a coping mechanism. And that's what I've had to do sometimes in the past. I recognize that the activity and the behavior I want to engage in is not healthy for me. It's very toxic, and it is very much so impulsive. But I have people that I can call when I want to do those impulsive things to tell me, but you know how you're going to feel in the morning. You know, or to so when I say self-talk, it's to really tell yourself that you're better than that situation. You know, you self-talk, if you cannot get mental health treatment, if you don't have the resources, the access, the courage, or any of that thing, learn self-talk. Self-talk. Talk in your head to yourself, but positively. We all have an inner voice, and most of the time our inner voice is negative. But you have to tell that inner voice that what they are telling you is not right. And that is like the best coping skill that I have managed out of all the therapy I've had and been taught. Self-talk has gotten me a long way. Evandra, that's not right. You're going to be mad in the morning. What if you had to tell that to somebody else and they knew about it? Those kind of things. Like, you're better than this. This is, you made it this far. You can keep going. It's not the end of the day. Those simple things that you tell yourself will make dealing with life a lot easier when you don't have any other way out. Is just to really talk to yourself. And a lot of times people say, I'm not talking to myself. That's crazy. Well, it's crazy to also not talk to yourself. So either way you lose.
Right.
You might as well just talk to yourself. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I literally was taking about 3 Xanax a day at one point in time in my life to manage the negative thoughts in my head. Not in an abusive way. I literally medically needed it. And then I realized that every time I would take the Xanax, within matter of minutes, I don't have no problems anymore. All magically gone away. My heart start racing. My hands stop sweating. I'm no longer in fight or flight mode. Then I started to realize some of this has got to be mental. So if some of it's mental, I need to go to where the problem is. And that is where my self-talk began. And I haven't had a Xanax in about 2 years. And it all was self-talk. They got me through being able to have to take a Xanax every day. We don't want to take medication as black folks. We don't want to be prescribed medication necessarily. But in the beginning of mental health, you do get prescribed medicine. But you can wean yourself off of it and live a life without medication, coping, healthy relationships, and talking to yourself. It's like only 3 things I could give anybody that is in a situation or a crisis right now is you just got to talk to yourself about it if you're not talking to anybody else.
I agree with that as I sit my crown royal. Not going to lie to you.
Well, we all take these behaviors all the time. We do. It's natural, but you have to know when it becomes toxic for you and when you might need to start addressing it within yourself.
Yeah, I'm not hanging out at the Greyhound bus station at night. I'm not to that point yet, but I enjoy a smooth cognac every now and again. Not yet. I'll be there soon.
No, I partake in respiratory therapy every day and very frequently. So, you know.
I'm royal.
Various gross.
Yeah.
It's nasty. But I will say alcohol is nasty. But that's my personal whatever. I just
you
don't
eat
like
booty, Pat. Let's put it out there.
as long as it's clean, it tastes better than alcohol. All
right, that was completely. I apologize for that one. We're going to recant that statement.
No, you don't. We ain't recanting nothing. That's on your record.
I recant.
That's on your record.
Alcohol is definitely a depressant.
Absolutely.
Right. Right. And
It's not a good choice all the time. I get it, but it's just it further, you know, exacerbates, as you said earlier, the problem. You're going to drink yourself into a deeper place of depression. It's not.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it feels good, but when it wore off, you have the same problems. You don't feel that great about yourself, and it depresses you further.
Absolutely.
Well,
be careful with alcohol.
And talking to yourself is not crazy, because I self-talk. Now, if you start having full-blown conversations with yourself, you know, now you're venturing into that area, the Twilight Zone. But, you know, as long as you know that you're the only person talking, you're good. The moment you start getting a little bit confused about how many people are in the conversation and you're the only person in the room, that's when you worry about getting crazy. So, you know, talk to yourself. Talking to yourself is good. But I do like that you keep hitting on positive, healthy relationships. Because, again, like, if you have a bunch of real friends around you, real people that really care about you, they're not going to let you slip into a hole and vanish for months on end. They're not going to let you do what you do. These are people that genuinely love you, care you, respect you, and want to see you do better. You know, like, coping becomes that much easier when you have people around you that can help, that can give you things that you can do, that can offer you conversation, that can give you a way out, that can offer you perspective. But again, it's far too many people out here don't have no real friends and don't know that they don't have no real friends. And so with that, ask you a question, Joe.
Okay, that's your setup?
Well, you got one, don't
okay.
you?
Okay. That's it. I was asking if that was your setup, because I know I have one. Okay. You caught that. You was here for that, so can't blame that on me. All right, so this is the point of the we ask all of our guests this one question, and
oh,
we like to get
question.
Various answers.
Oh, now he wanted to have a question.
No, I thought he had another question, not my question. You know, I'm always waiting for mine.
But it's that time of the show, Pat.
It's the first of the month.
Oh my God.
Well, we've been off script. I thought we were just gonna keep off scripting it. You know, I like off script.
Off scripting, huh?
Off script.
Hey, man.
All right. Off script now.
Don't. You know I'm from the South. Don't do that.
All right,
you
whatever.
Live in Texas, Jamie. Stop it.
That's a fact.
All right. So this is how we, like I say, we ask everybody this question. This is how we set it up for Pat, because this is his favorite question. And so we got a little extra.
So, if you were the all-powerful, all-able ruler of Black America, what would you change, and what would your message to the people be?
Oh, man. So I would, of course, change education, just the whole system of education for Black people. But the focus would be really to save Black men. My message goes along with that is I am really trying to save the Black male species, like, with every ounce of me every single day, every single day. And that's my research focus. That's my interest. That's what all my books will be written on. It is very problematic for me to know some of the statistics that face our Black men every single day. And without focusing on Black men, this is how I see it, I can't really be for the progression of my race. I can't be pro-Black. I can't be Afrocentric. I can't be out here trying to make change in the Black community, because at the end of the day, if the Black male species become extinct, we don't have no Black sperm. We don't have no Black babies. There's no Black people.
Yep.
And it's very, very, very real, very, very, very real to me to make sure that this invisibility of Black males in America, we change that ASAP, immediately, right now. And as an all-Black and all-powerful ruler, my national campaign would be to find a way to make Black men visible. I don't care who would vote for me or not, but that's what it's going to be. We have no real national campaign that has focused on Black men in this country ever, except President Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative, and we're still trying to pave the way through that. And I can just give some quick, like, reasons why. We have 1 in 20 Black men that spend time in jail or prison. They're at least 6.6 times more likely to be arrested. 37% of all male inmates were Black in 2008. We have only 4 million black male students that make up the public school population, and about 50% of them are labeled educable, mentally retarded. Like, that is a problem. Between 1980 and 1995, the suicide rate for black men ages 15 to 19, 146% increase. 2.5 times less likely to be considered gifted or talented. No other population of people on this planet have those types of statistics but black men in America. It is problematic for me. Very, very problematic for me. And so when I become the all-powerful ruler with some other rulers with me, because I don't want to be a leader of, like, all black people. I want some leaders with me. This is what we have to focus on. This is what the message needs to be. The black woman is heading household at, like, 75% at this point. We've got to change that. We're losing. New York Times already told us 1.5 million black males are missing out of the community, either incarcerated or death. We're losing here with trying to be progressing our race, but not focusing on how our race is going to continue. If we don't have black sperm, we don't have black babies. And there's 83 black men, so every 100 women. So you're telling me for every dude I see that I might be interested in, I got 16 other chicks I got to fight through to get to him? As a black woman, I'm not happy about that at all. Like, I can barely open up a spaghetti jar in my house. Like, I need a black man to come up in here and do that for me. And so we as a community of people, as a diaspora, have to focus back on our black men because we are losing them at a very, very high rate right now. And it's not going to be to anybody's good to sit here and keep fighting for the black race when the black race is not going to be no longer. So that would be my answer to that question. My message would simply be very explicit, is that we're talking a lot in the black community, but what we're not talking about are black men. And we got to do it. We have to do it. Where black men are idolized in for basketball, whatever to say, sports, music, entertainment, culture, clothing, they're idolized. This, black men are the face of that. But then yet we have these statistics on the other end. It makes no sense to me. They're the only group of people in the only population of people that has that love-hate relationship with society. I love that you do everything for me in all these places over here, but I hate the very mere fact of you over here. It makes no sense to me how we can have that love-hate relationship with the black man at all. It's just not going to work out for the future. We're going to be fighting for what here if we're not making any babies? We don't have any black men to make those babies. So that would be what I would do if I was the ruler of black people.
We got to start maintaining the black family is important. That's important.
Yes, and we can't do that without the black men, and so many people think we can. It's not going to work. It's just not. Right. It's not a balance. A balance of nature. That's just not the balance. We need black males in the household in some capacity. We need them in the household. Like, if we can just get them back in the house, we can start working on roles and responsibilities. But we don't even have them in the house yet. And that's as a black woman, those statistics fall back on me. I'm the what is it? The last married, the first divorce. Like, hold on. I don't want that statistic.
That has to change ASAP.
Yes, that falls back on me as a black woman. These statistics become mine. Why I'm heading households. Like, I don't want to do that. That's nothing that I woke up one morning and said. That's not what the ancestors would like to be the case. That's just not how our community collective sense of agency as a group of people work. We don't do this without the black man. But Western culture has taught us that we no longer need the brute, the savage, the unintellectual. We don't need that person anymore. Black women, you can do it all. You've been doing it all since slavery. Wait a minute. That's not working out. We need black men. It's simple. We need them.
Yes, ma'am. Well, as a black man, I love you. And I love what you're saying, what you're bringing to the table. Because now it's just real because Patrick and I have conversations all the time about black women like you actually having a voice and a platform to say everything that you just said, because we mostly get the negative messages and people talking down and beating down on black men. And it goes the other way as well. We usually hearing those messages about black women. But to hear a black woman be unapologetic about her love for black men as a black man, I truly appreciate that, because that makes me feel great about myself as a black man, but also makes me want to work harder so our black women can be safer, can be empowered, and our black women can have the spaces that they need to really self-actualize and become who they want to be.
Yes, man, it's ridiculous. I appreciate that so much. You know, I have a son. I didn't mention that, but I do have a son, 7 years old, and I'm also in a relationship. And I lay down at night and I think of that black man that's laying on my chest, that's needing that hug, that's needing to be nurtured, that's so sensitive at that moment. And then when he walks out that front door, he has a whole world of hate waiting for him out there. And I just thought, in my spirit, I'm unsettled about that. I'm unsettled that the same black man that's in here, in my home and in my space every day, showing sensitivity and masculinity at the same time, that when he walks outside, he has a physical reaction in his body every time a police drive past. Regardless of what activity he participating in, there's a physical reaction. There's a change in heart rate and blood pressure by the sheer sight of a police person or law enforcement or even a white person. That doesn't settle my spirit at all, because I know that that same black man just walked out of my house in my lap being a big old freaking baby, not even having a care in the world, but then got to have a physical response every time he walks outside. That's not cool with me as a black woman. I can't function like that at all. Not a
yes,
little
ma'am.
Bit. That doesn't work, because that's not real. That's just not what he should have to face. Like, what?
Exactly.
No, it's not. Not at all. I watch it all the time. I watch my black men all the time, and I just see how they can just be sitting, chilling on the porch, drinking a bottle of water, and even want to set that a little bit off to the side because the police might think it's some vodka. Like, nobody else is doing that. Nobody.
Yes, ma'am.
Nobody
That's true.
Nobody has to always see that damn alert, that freaking conscious, all day long, all the freaking time, because they are freaking a black man. Nobody. Nobody's doing that. At all.
You're definitely speaking truth. You're definitely speaking truth. Man.
You know, it's a point in time when the Black Panthers made you walk outside butt naked so that the police knew you didn't have a gun on you as a black man. Take all your clothes off before you go out and surrender. We're still facing that.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
No, you're good. I mean, this is the show for you to speak your mind, and speak your peace. Because we want our people to get the truth. We want our people to have true empowerment, so we can have true liberation. And we ain't trying to hold no punches back. And it ain't like you ain't saying nothing that don't need to be told. So thank you for saying what you're saying.
You're welcome. As we think about mental health, we have to think about all of these things. And as a person that deals with mental health, that affects my mental health, knowing where black people, black men are in America. That affects my mental health. I'm not all the way going to be mentally healthy knowing these things. And you guys shouldn't be either, and nobody else should be either. And we got to keep fighting for the progression of black men before we can start fighting for the progression of the black race. It's just, it doesn't work any other way, because, like I said, no black sperm, no black baby.
That's a fact.
Yes, ma'am. So, but before we wrap this up, like, because you speak with fire and passion and more, and I'm sure those who don't know of you are going to learn more about you. But if somebody wants to invite you out to come speak or come give some information, where can people find you?
Like you said, I'm all over the internet. Evandra Catherine is a Googleable name. I got Google Analytics on height right
up.
Now.
That's what's up.
But I am very transparent. I'm very reachable. You can Facebook inbox me, Instagram DM me, Twitter DM me. EvandraCatherine.me is the website. Email is EvandraCatherine@gmail.com. It's a brand. Just Evandra Catherine. I'm the only one that exists and will ever exist because I created the name myself. So, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Dr. Catherine, you'll one day be able to find me that way. But I am all the way available, and my response rate is like 10 minutes. You hit me up, I'm getting back to you. Like, what you need, especially if it's anything to do with the uplifting of black people around the world and black peoples of America. And I don't, one day I hope y'all have a topic discussion about African Americans versus Black people, because I would love to have that conversation. I like not call my Black people African Americans at all, but Black people, I'm all down for y'all.
That's interesting. That look at her. She over here giving us, you know, a new shows, and look at that. I appreciate that.
You really need one down. Because we have a problem with that right now in 2017. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think no one uses
African-Americans
but the oppressor. I've never heard nobody refer to themselves as an African-American.
Mm-hmm.
I think the oppressor uses that term, and I refuse to allow the oppressor to continue to call me African-American.
Oh, look at her starting up some stuff. Mazel tov. Mazel tov.
I'll be more than happy to come join you on that
section. That, straight up. Now we're going to have to add another category in there.
I don't think we've had a whole show on it, but we have gotten into it on rare occasion. But maybe it is time for a whole show.
Yeah.
We're going to have to add another category into it, too. Black people, African Americans, and niggas. So got to add them in there because we got to talk about them, too.
You know, the real reason why it needs to be a conversation is because people does not need to assume everyone with black skin is an African American. We do have some Caribbean folks that's out here chilling with us. We do have some
folks
in America and South America that look just like you and I, and people call them African American. And we allow it to happen because we don't correct the term. Like, black people are not all African Americans. I get where it comes from, but now we live in a place where, you know, your Jamaican brother or sister sitting right there, Haitian brother or sister sitting right there, that we allow them to call them African-American. We are a diverse group of people. We come from every continent in the world. Like, they need to get it together. We black people.
Yes, ma'am.
You can miss
black
with
power.
African rhetoric. Like, you miss you with that.
No, but that's real, though. That's real because, you know, trying to teach people that even our ancestors used the term black as a collective consciousness for the diaspora as a whole. So we need to be able to understand that.
Exactly, because we further oppress our own sisters and brothers by letting them be called something that they are not. You know what I mean? Like, my boyfriend is Creole, technically descending from Haiti and from France. That is not an African-American. Let's talk about it. But that's what he is.
Right.
And the census even took African-American off the census. It's either black or African descent. There's no more African-American in the census. Let's be real, right? It's not a term that even we use on government documents anymore. Another thing.
We're going to make that happen. We're going to hold you to that. We're going to make that happen. So.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys. Y'all been amazing.
Oh, no, you have been amazing. Thank you. Like, I mean, this just, like, for the first two shows that we had for people who actually work in mental health to help others who have mental health issues, and then to get your perspective, your story, your passion, and everything from you, we truly, 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 truly appreciate you giving us your time, your energy, your effort, your information. And I know this interview is going to help a lot of people, so thank you.
Very welcome, very welcome. It's always a pleasure to be in the company of black men. Always a pleasure.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, we appreciate you. Like I said, you gave a lot of good information, and I think it's going to help a lot of people. So we truly appreciate you, and hopefully we can get you back in here, talk some stuff. In a less formal, that way you kind of see how we get down. You know, we got to be professional, you know, doing this point. But we get down a little bit. You know, we get a little ignorant.
Not what you talking about, King Booty.
All right, I said, we deleting that out.
Down.
All right, thank you.
We're going to delete that out, Joe. Relax.
Well, thank you very much, and we definitely going to stay in contact with you.
Of course, anytime.
Yes, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah. Hey, Pat.
Pat,
we ain't know you eat booty, Pat.
Yeah,
Jamie told the whole world.
Hey, man, if you a grown man and you don't eat booty, that's wrong with you.
You got that Kevin Gates booty. You're the booty warrior out here. Booty is more important than water. Booty is...
Hey, man, y'all are crazy, man. But now that was a fire interview. She gave a lot of great information.
Yes, she did.
And I hope you once again, third week in a row, pull your pen and your pad out. I hope you took notes. I hope you were able to take at least one thing away from what she was saying, especially if it wasn't even on the mental health side, some of the black pride side of loving who you are and working to find yourself. She overcame a lot to be able to not only work to improve her mental health, but to find out who she is and still be selfless enough to give herself to the community. So you got to give your hat off to someone like that, because she could be like everybody else and just only concentrate on herself, but she's not. So we got to praise the people in our community who are like her.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah. Hey, man, so next week we're going live, right? We live next week. We're on our YouTube channel. We're going live from the YouTube channel the Sunday, but we'll still have the audio through the podcast on that Wednesday, so still expect the audio to drop Wednesday, but we're going live next Sunday, 6:30, on the Freedom Train YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Freedom Train Network. It's going down. You get to see my face, you get to see Jamie's face, and you get to see Patrick's face, you get to see Jamie's mustache, and it's
hell
going down.
Yes. My mustache is growing epically, man. I'm not cutting it till 2018, so it's going to look like a damn underbrush here in a second. My flavor.
It's going to look like Yosemite Sam.
Hell yeah. That's what I'm striving right. for.
That is. Have y'all got any parting words before we get off this line?
Pat, do you prefer jelly or syrup?
I prefer it raw, actually.
Tabasco.
Yo.
Hey, man. We stupid, but it's all good, man. Hey, it's the Freedom Train podcast series. That's how we get down. I'm Joseph Ward. He's Patrick Irvin. He's Jamie Bashan. Thank you to Dr. Evangel Catherine for coming through. And y'all know how we get down. Until next time, until next week, two fingers in the air, and keep your mouth clean. Yeah. Thank you.